Good morning, and welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I'm Michael West, and as you can see, I'm your lay leader today. I'd like to extend a welcome once again to Reverend Mark Skrabosch. Mark is a longtime friend and member of the extended First UU community. Reverend Skrabosch is the called and settled minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Hills in Kerrville, Texas. Mark graduated from St. Edward's High School right here in Austin, and he earned his undergraduate degree in speech and drama from the University of Notre Dame and a Master of Divinity from the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley. He serves on the board at UBRU Retreat and Conference Center out in Kerrville. He teaches yoga and meditation at the yoga space in Kerrville as well. If you've had the pleasure of knowing Mark, getting to know him, you will know that he loves to orchestrate conscious change in the community, wherever he is. He likes being with people, facilitating groups, as well as teaching spiritual awareness, taking time to hike, read, write, dance, sing, and also work in the garden. We welcome Mark back to our pulpit. He's a former member of our church and was quite active in a variety of capacities, including stewardship, listening ministries, and singing as a tenor in the choir. Here at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, we are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. Our opening words today will come from the book Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen and David Oliver Rellin. I have joined many of you in accepting the challenge to the entire First UU community to acknowledge the place of personal social action in this world of need. With taxi driver Abdullah's hands scarred by war, steering them around bomb craters, Greg Mortensen and donor Julia Bergman toured a cluster of 80 villages west of Kabul. Mortensen knew that most of the foreign aid now trickling into Afghanistan would never make it out of Kabul. As was his strategy in Pakistan, he was anxious to serve Afghanistan's rural poor. The 300 students at the Shahabuddin Middle School were in need of much more than the pencils and notebooks that they had unloaded from the trunk of the taxi. The Shahabuddin teachers held class for the younger boys in rusty shipping containers. The school's oldest students, ninth grade boys, studied in the back of a scorched, armored personnel carrier that had had a gunner's hatch, which they used as a window. The class displayed their prized possession, a volleyball given to them by a Swedish aid worker. But it was the lack of shelter for the school's female students that tore particularly at Mortensen's heart. 80 girls were forced to study outside, Mortensen said. They were trying to hold class, but the wind kept whipping the sand in their eyes and tipping over their blackboard. They were thrilled with the new notebooks and pencils and clutched the notebooks tightly to keep them from blowing away. As Mortensen walked back to his taxi, four U.S. Army Cobra attack helicopters buzzed the school at high speed, streaking 50 feet above the terrified students with full payloads of Hellfire missiles bristling from their weapon pods. The girls' blackboard blew down in the blast of the rotor wash, shattering against the stony ground. In a land where many have been held ignorant, where many have been killed and injured, and their lives destroyed by war and invasion, age after age, there will be much to forgive.
Elwin Hope Wilson is 73 years old. He lives in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and suffers from severe diabetes. Last year, he became something of a celebrity because after a lifetime of racist rhetoric and activity, he had a change of heart. As a young man, Wilson assaulted civil rights freedom riders. Later in life, he threatened a real estate agent who had sold a nearby home to a black family. And another time, he vehemently protested the desegregation of a local cemetery where his parents were interred. On another occasion, he hung a black doll by the neck in his front yard and dared his neighbors to remove it. He regularly embarrassed his children and grandchildren by loudly repeating racial epithets in restaurants and other public places. But then, last year, that all changed. Having decided that his previous behavior had been horribly misguided, Wilson began the painful process of issuing apologies. He traveled to Congressman John Lewis's Washington, D.C. office to personally apologize for punching and knocking him down, that freedom rider from 1961. He visited black churches and offered public declarations of repentance. And he sought reconciliation with black citizens throughout his own community. Many have greeted Elwin Wilson's apologies with surprise and pleasure, and others, maybe some in this room, might be a little more skeptical. One freedom rider allowed, "In the back of my mind, I keep thinking, why now? Why now indeed?" Although it's always hazardous to render judgments about another person's motives, one thing was clear. Elwin Hope Wilson, beset with serious health problems, was scared. "I'm going to hell," he desperately told a friend, to which his friend replied, "The Bible says, if you truly ask forgiveness and you mean it in your heart, you can be saved." At that moment, Wilson felt that perhaps he could escape the hellfire that he believed was awaiting him. So what are we to make of Elwin Wilson's attempt to reconcile himself to his victims? How legitimate were his apologetic gestures? There can be no doubt that the man had a great deal to be sorry about, and that a sincere and heartfelt apology for his egregious offenses was in order. And there can also be no doubt that Elwin Wilson went the extra mile. Like the medieval penitents who were ordered by Catholic confessors to undertake lengthy, arduous pilgrimages in order to atone for their sins, Wilson, likewise, has made a strenuous effort to demonstrate remorse in many places and before many people, including members of his own family. Wilson's apologies have made him the object of considerable attention, and now he receives regular requests to speak publicly about his conversion, a role he really doesn't relish. He isn't interested in the publicity, and having said he's sorry, he just wants to be free of the painful past and gain some measure of hope for the future. This brings up at least one issue having to do with forgiveness. If the injured party senses that the apology is not an expression of empathy and compassion for their suffering, but only an attempt to assuage the perpetrator's pain, it may fall on deaf ears. A genuine apology focuses on the feelings of other people rather than how the one who apologizes is going to benefit in the end. The words must communicate the desire not so much to be saved, but to be in right relationship. Which is why Elwin Wilson's apology to people of color, though powerful, still feels unsatisfying. Genuine or authentic apologies include these essential elements: a clear admission of fault or blameworthiness for specific injuries and without excuse or justification, an unambiguous acceptance of responsibility for what we've done. 2, a sincere expression of remorse and regret for the damage our words or actions caused. An appropriate offer of reparation and restitution for said damage. And finally, a commitment not to repeat such behavior in the future. Yet if the apology is half-hearted or seems inauthentic, how might it be reflected? The victim might simply say, "I'm sorry, but I need a better apology than that." to which the offender might have to engage in more self-scrutiny and discover a new message in which all or at least more of these important elements are present. Now, you can say anything you want to yourself or to other people about forgiveness, but we'll probably all agree saying so doesn't make it so. True forgiveness requires much more. It requires transformation, oftentimes mourning, and insight, and some, as in the Jewish tradition, would add restitution too. For while forgiveness may be freeing, it isn't cheap. One way to misconstrue forgiveness is to promote a cheap and easy version of it. You see, forgiveness is not the same as forgetting. Past experiences and the pain they cause have a great deal to teach us so that we can try to avoid these patterns, or better yet, change them in the future. For forgiveness to function in a life-enhancing way, it more often requires remembering rather than forgetting. Forgiveness is not approving or condoning. Forgiving someone often involves making some effort to understand them. But even if we come to fully understand them, we do not thereby conclude that their actions were acceptable. True understanding cannot occur when I in any way deny, minimize, justify, or condone the actions that harmed me. So let's be clear about a couple of these givens. Forgiveness is not cheap, and it's not easy. It's not the same as forgetting or condoning, or it's not a form of self-sacrifice. As we move into considering what forgiveness actually is, I'd like to invite you to get in touch with a situation or a wound that still has a hold on you, that somehow diminishes you. And I'd like to move this sermon out of the field of the abstract and into the practical. So I'll give you a moment right now to examine your lives and see if there's something that still has a hold on you and diminishes you. So what wound still has a hold on you? Some of you may have chosen yourself as the focus of this, which brings up a good point. We all need our own forgiveness for the things we've done. And looking at it from another perspective, we need to forgive ourselves about the situations in which we have been hurt. We need to forgive ourselves for not having been able to stop what happened, for having limits to our control, for not having more information, or for not making different choices. We're often reluctant to admit how much pain we have and how much our life has been altered. And in the aftermath, we have to engage our own feelings of vengeance and so on. This requires bountiful compassion for oneself, even as we hold ourselves accountable for past actions. I imagine some of us chose another person or set of people who hurt us. We are in great need of intrapersonal forgiveness. Showing compassion for perpetrators of injustice or pain is a tall order. It's a natural human response to ask, why should we be concerned about compassion for the perpetrators? We feel we must focus our effort on those who suffered the injustice, not those who caused it. But there's no such thing as wholeness for you, or wholeness for me, or wholeness for only the deserving. Either there's wholeness for everyone, or there's no wholeness. Compassion that has to be earned by good behavior isn't compassion. Injustice and lack of forgiveness wounds the perpetrator as well as the target. And our compassion isn't like some scarce medicine that we have to hoard lest we run out. Compassion begets more compassion. Every time we show compassion, the doors of our hearts swing open wider. And this is not about condoning oppression or going easy on those who are hurtful Everyone has to take responsibility for the consequences of his or her actions. We can insist on that and at the same time show compassion toward the perpetrator. Now, I imagine some of you chose a higher power when you're thinking about an area for forgiveness, however you may experience that higher power. Many of us have anger toward the larger structure of things because of unfair personal losses we've experienced. I know that was the sort of forgiveness that I most had in mind when I wrote this sermon. I remember when I lost my father as a young man. It was almost unbearable. I was so angry. I wasn't done with my relationship with my dad. I raged and I cried for over a year. Eventually, I got the lesson that I had to forgive. I had to once again let go of the way I thought things were supposed to be, and I had to come back to a relationship with life itself. So some of us may have chosen the universe itself as what we need to forgive. We know that letting go is a difficult practice, yet for those who have let go, isn't it amazing how that experience makes room for something else to show up? Like carrying around a big sheet of armor in front of you, you know, and you drop it and, whew, what a relief. We have to let go of something that may be killing us in order for new life to emerge. Now, as I come to the end of my remarks, I want to emphasize what forgiveness is. It's a turning to the good in the face of wrongdoing or injustice. It is merciful restraint from dwelling destructively in resentment or thoughts of vengeance. Not that resentment or thoughts of vengeance are always bad. Anger need not disappear for forgiveness to be real. It need only cease to prevail as the main focus of our attention. Forgiveness involves overcoming of injustice with good. We must come to wish ourselves, others, and the universe well. In spite of everything, we wish betterment and flourishing of the subject of our forgiveness. And as we give the gift of forgiveness, we ourselves move toward healing. But forgiveness is a process. I want to recall that story from the First Nations tradition of our land where the grandfather sitting with his grandson and he says, inside of each of us, there are two wolves fighting. Many of you probably heard this. There's the wolf of vengeance and resentment, and there's the wolf of compassion and forgiveness. And the grandson looks at the grandfather and says, "But which wolf will win this fight?" The grandfather says, "The one we feed." So what are we feeding? An adult I know was abused by her mother as a child. Through a lot of work and therapy, she eventually saw that her mother's violence toward her was less and less malevolent and powerful, and she saw her mother as a weak and pitiful victim of her own life. She strove to understand her mother's own childhood and suffering abuse at the hands of her father. That put her own injurious events in a context of understanding the pressure that her mother was under, and the role modeling that her mother received. This new perspective did not excuse her mother, but it helped the daughter to see that her mother was a member of a wounded human community. And some significant amount of empathy and compassion was generated. The woman had to accept the pain that she received as the result of her mother's actions, even though she had no sense that she deserved this pain, and she knew it had been unjustly given. Still, she decided not to pass the pain on to others, nor, very importantly, to pass it back to her mother. Eventually, the woman began to offer goodwill directly to her mother, and there was some reconciliation. And in so doing, this woman moved toward growth, toward life enhancement, toward an embracing of life again. I found this column in a recent European edition of a magazine from the United Kingdom, an apology in lieu of hard time. Rewarding criminals if they apologize for their crimes would save the state a lot of money. A victims' rights group recently released a report that analyzes in hard cash terms what happens when hardened criminals who have no sense of conscience are offered the chance to examine their conscience through therapy and through understanding of that part of themselves. They're offered the chance to apologize to reduce their sentences, apologizing face to face to the victims of their crime. The findings are stunning. In Northern Ireland, the apology method is credited with contributing to a 25% reduction of recidivism. These people don't want to do that crime again after facing their victims and digging up this stuff, not forgetting, but remembering their need to apologize. Prisons minister now wants to introduce restorative justice to the rest of Britain. Well, we'll see how that shakes out. The act of facing their victims and expressing contrition really has been found to bring about a painful but beneficial evaluation of past actions. That from the real world. Forgiveness is hard work. It's a long process. Forgiveness is free, but it's not cheap. It may be a good idea to visit our injuries and resentments regularly to see if forgiveness is in order. I invite you to choose an area in your life this coming week to walk a little further along the path of forgiveness. A sage once prayed, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." Indeed, may our trespasses be forgiven by those we have harmed, and may we be the first to do the difficult and whole-making work of forgiveness. May it be so. As we leave this sanctuary, let us remember that forgiveness is forgiving. Forgiveness is paradoxical, for as we give our compassion and forgiveness, so are we healed. Let us remember that there is no partial wholeness. There is wholeness or none. We are called to live wholeheartedly. May we go in whole.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.